Welcome to Hometown Alaska. I'm your host, Kathleen McCoy. Our discussion today started at a conference last week in Anchorage and in Fairbanks on polar law. People came from many points north and south, but from Iceland, Greenland, Canada, Norway, Denmark, Australia, to talk about how law and scholarship can improve the lives of Arctic peoples and the places they live in. These folks have been meeting all around the polar region since 2007. This was their first time in Alaska. Our guests today, Betsy Baker and Mara Kimmel, both of Anchorage, not only organized this event, but participated in many, many discussions dealing with who gets to govern resources in the Arctic. That's just a generalization of what they talked about. In my layman's terms, I think of it as who's in charge and how's it working out for everybody. So I invited them to join us today to offer some takeaways that your average Anchorage resident can appreciate. We may not be lawyers or resource managers, but Alaska's our home. Its borders touch the Arctic and the subarctic. The issues there swirl all around us in Alaska. So please welcome our guests, two fascinating women committed to their work. I'd like to welcome Mara Kimmel.
Thank you. Hello.
And I've been waiting all week to say that you are the Walter J. Hickel Professor of Strategic Planning and Entrepreneurship at APU. And we'll get back to more of your academic world in a second. And then there's also Betsy Baker. Welcome, Betsy, an Anchorage resident who is professor at the Vermont School of Law and the Alaska Liaison for the University of Washington School of Law. Betsy, I don't know how you can do all of those things at once, but welcome to Hometown Alaska, and we're really happy to have you here. And of course, we consider our listeners part of our guests, and we'd welcome you to join this conversation. You know, if you've got questions, we've got two great people that you can pitch your questions to, or if you just have a comment about sort of being in Alaska and being close to the Arctic. Here's our phone numbers. We invite you to call us at 550-8433 in Anchorage or 1-888-353-5752 statewide. And we can also take your email at hometown@alaskapublic.org. So I just want to get back to introducing our guests a little bit more thoroughly. Betsy, one question I have for you is, what's your middle B? Your Betsy B. Baker.
Berryman, a family name. One of my grandmother's maiden names.
I thought that was really cool that I don't know. I just like that. And let's see, I understand that you've been sort of getting engaged with Alaska more and more on polar issues. And actually, in our pre-show conversation, I learned that you're one of the world's experts on, how would we phrase this exactly? I'm looking
at Mara. Betsy is one of the world's experts on the UN Convention on the Law
of the
Sea.
The Law of the Sea, which is complex and the U.S. has not yet signed on.
That's correct.
And I heard some interesting discussions at the conference about why they might want to and what are the concerns and how might those concerns be addressed. So that's that. And Mara, I wanted to mention that you happen to be an advisor to our mayor. You're married to our very sort of short-term, still moving into the full swing of things, Ethan Berkowitz. How you managed to do polar conferences and defend your thesis this morning, which
Yay.
Is something. And was it on polar issues?
It was, actually. It was on land well-being and governance in America's Arctic.
Yeah. So, which was one of the themes running through this conference.
Yes.
I did say, you know, boy, we have lots of calls coming in. Okay. Let me just get you guys to tell me how this became your passion, in particular, you know, polar law of the sea. You don't start out as a five-year-old saying, oh, I'm going to be an expert on the law of the sea. So Betsy, with you.
Sure. Before I answer that, though, I would like to be sure to thank all of the Anchorage-based institutions that supported us. Stoll Reeves Law Firm, Landy Bennett Blumstein Law Firm, Davis Wright Tremaine, also a firm here in town, Perkins Coie, Bering Straits Native Corporation, WWF Alaska, and the Alaska Humanities Forum. And the reason I want to list all those is not only for their support, but it shows the range of interests that really do want to support this kind of discussion.
Mm-hmm. Right. I think that's great. And it wouldn't have happened if they weren't there.
And would not have happened without the Vermont and Washington Law Schools, APU, UAA, mm-hmm. and UAF, and just all of the wonderful people that, mm-hmm. that helped make sure this happened. So thanks to everybody.
You know, we're going to go back to your passion and 5 years old as a Law of the Sea expert. But it feels as if somebody cracked an egg open and suddenly Arctic is everywhere in Alaska. I know it's been other places, but it's probably President Obama's visit maybe had something to do with it. I don't know. It just feels like it suddenly emerged.
Well, I also think it's the assumption of the chairmanship of the Arctic Council.
Sure,
that's also
course.
A big precipitating factor. And then it's the product of a lot of work that a lot of us have been doing around the state for many, many years to try to highlight the role of the Arctic in our own state. I'm also part of the Institute of the North, and that that institute's mission is to promote the awareness of Arctic issues in our state.
Mm-hmm. Does that have something to do with your passion for the Arctic? I mean, it's I think of you as very people focused. How's it affecting people? You know, are they participating at the table or someone deciding things for them? And I feel like that's been with you for a very long time.
Yes, exactly. It has, and it's been my motivator in doing the work that I do. And you can have a very uniquely Alaska spin on justice issues.
Yes.
And the fact that we are so far away from the seats of decision making really has impacts on who we are as a people and as a culture and a community in the state. And so that's where the notions of justice, the notions of being able to engage in our own future and help to determine our own fate is really something that matters to all of us dearly as Alaskans.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Betsy, I just don't want to, you know, how did you end up being so captivated by that top of the globe?
Well, it's actually quite recent, uh-huh. and it started at an Arctic Science Summit Week back in 2007, when in fact I met with some UAF faculty, and they, through various conversations, I ended up on the Healy, on the icebreaker, mapping the continental shelf. I was there as an international lawyer because I use the same treaty that the scientists do mm-hmm. to understand who gets what portion of continental shelf rights.
Mm.
And being introduced to the Arctic Ocean in high summer, surrounded by light and ice, as far as you could see, was utterly transforming. And it took the years of book learning that I had from teaching law of the sea and writing about it, and it gave it a very practical bent. We need scientists and lawyers to talk together in order to make the best case for how far out our shelf rights extend. We need lawyers and scientists to talk together to make sure we have the best regulations in place.
Mm-hmm.
And that work also allowed me to then spend a year at the State Department helping the United States draft a prototype for what our science and law advocacy document will say mm-hmm. about the extent of our shelf.
Mm-hmm.
And there are many other related issues about the use of marine resources that have engaged me very deeply in the 7 or 8 years since then.
Yeah. I mean, I think about the health of the oceans, the health of the, you know, how we're taking care of the globe. I mean, it feels like the polar regions might be the last place that we get to do it right, maybe. And also, so much drifts to the poles. So whatever we've done elsewhere, it's there too. You know?
Yeah, it may be the last place to do things right, but it is one of the first places we need to act because of the fact that we're experiencing changes at such a rapid rate up here mm-hmm. and our communities are being so impacted.
Mm-hmm. So I want to go to the phones. We've got a number of people calling. I'd like to welcome Christine Hess. Hi, Christine. You're on Hometown Alaska.
Hello.
Hi. Did you have a question for us?
Yeah, I guess my question would be, moving forward, how do you think Alaska could get better recognized and better input at both the federal and international level?
Sort of your point, Mara, a little bit about being so far away, removed from the decision makers. I don't know. What can we do?
Well, and I think there's a two-part answer to that. One is that we need to continue to educate ourselves about the fact that we are an Arctic nation by virtue of Alaska. And that was part of the purpose of this symposium last week, was that we wanted to take the opportunity to make sure that Alaskans, and specifically the Alaska legal community, was able to really understand that we do have a role to play in the development of Arctic policy, the burgeoning development of Arctic policy, but also to engage on a more global level with practitioners and policymakers, as we, again, were able to last week.
That was so interesting because many of the Alaska issues, I could pick this up listening, it was the first time they got Alaska's version of what the issues are, and it was really different than what they've been talking about so far. Betsy, anything to jump in there and add to Christine's question?
Well, Christine was also gracious to participate in the symposium, and there are many things going on in the Northwest Arctic Borough that our examples to the rest of the Arctic. And I think that's, it doesn't exactly engage you perhaps in the decision making, Christine, the way your question framed it, but I think it is a really important role to be able to point to the kinds of renewable energy. You're thinking about ports and your cooperation with academic institutions as a model for how to address problems.
Right. I'm actually flashing on this image I saw in, I think it was the Nome Nugget, and it was a village meeting where people at a meeting were saying, we need to be a part of this decision. Like it was swirling over them, and the look in this man's face was, he was sort of desperate, you know, because I think there's a great sense that they're not, many people are not at the table, and who is at the table and where are the meetings? You know, how do you, one of the things we're going to talk about before the show is over is how to stay up to speed and how to keep yourself informed. So that picture in an image captured what I think many people feel about it's getting away from us, or, you know, I was never really invited to the discussion, maybe. Let's see. I would like to welcome Lisa. Hello, Lisa. You're on Hometown Alaska.
Hi, my name is Lisa Holland.
Welcome.
Thank you.
And you have a question about water rights?
Yes, I was involved in Lake Tahoe water rights back in the 70s with my mother, and we stopped with overpopulation and giving South Tahoe to big business and keeping the water rights in North Tahoe limited to where only wells could not be drilled. Will that possibly be used as a legal right to be able to control industrialization and preserve a lot of the native lands that are viable for their survival?
We're pondering.
There was a discussion at the symposium about water rights and the application of the doctrines that typically apply in the lower 48 states and their lack of application to Alaska. I'm not entirely sure that I'm following. I don't know enough about the Lake Tahoe situation, but I do know that things like the federal Indian reserved water rights doctrines do not apply in Alaska. And so we have to make our own way, which is another reason to have these kinds of conversations.
Yeah, because I was involved with the Yes, Yes, Yes campaign, especially the Yes on Thor, and the water rights were transferred from the department to the political realm. And that's what was slightly worrying. Troublesome.
I think that you raise a really great point, which is that we have an opportunity to restructure the way we make decisions in our state. And having people have the ability to come to a table and have their voices heard is a question that we've always grappled with as Alaskans. And again, it's something that we need to continue to grapple with.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Lisa. I'd like to welcome Diane. Hi, Diane. You're on Hometown Alaska.
Hi, thank you. This is Diane Benson, and I want to say thank you, first of all, to Betsy and Mara for organizing such a wonderful symposium. And I thought it was great for Alaska to be hosting it for the first time. And I wanted to just make some comments in light of this discussion and having been a participant at the symposium. Alaska is involved. You know, Fran Ulmer and Mead Treadwell and a number of others in the leadership positions have been engaging in energy summits and other organizational activities regarding issues of transport and business in the Arctic. But I think for general Alaskans, and it's hard to say, but as an academic, and I work for the Department of Alaska Native Studies and Rural Development, it was really beneficial to attend the symposium, particularly for the dialogue between academics, business, and law experts, and other knowledgeable citizens from around the globe who are interested in the Arctic, and the variety of topics and research. But that just displays to me how much policy there is to discuss and even resolve. I mean, we are looking, as Alaskans, I think we've been looking at the development of resources, as have the other nations, and kind of what nation is going to get what piece of what pie, pretty much all driven as a result of climate change, warming in the Arctic, and the enabling the passage. And as nations, we have to engage with one another, and it can't just be the leadership. So as citizens in symposiums like this, we build relationships and entertain concepts and solutions. And so I found that very valuable to have that kind of an exchange. Mm-hmm. Having been in Savoonga recently, and I am Indigenous, and so I have to address something along those lines and the interest, I think, on Indigenous involvement. Having been in Savoonga recently, I was informed up there about the lessening of sea ice from the north and what that means for them, less hunting opportunity, ability to feed the families on traditional foods like walrus. And then there are impending issues, of course, of impact on sea life by heavy transport traffic. So there are issues of people's well-being, the life of the sea, the increase of pollutants, and the relationships between nations. Mm-hmm. And at the symposium, papers were presented, and often regarding Native perspectives or concern for the vulnerability of Indigenous peoples who are impacted by Arctic activity. In fact, one addressed Indigenous involvement in specific marine policies, and that was on building an Indigenous evidence base for tribally led habitat conservation policies. What it came down to is, what's happening with the walrus in the St. Lawrence Islands and some of the other areas.
So Diane, it's kind of like you, in your mind, you bridge these high, maybe high level or abstract policy discussions, and you're seeing the people that are directly affected by them, and you know, trying to bring those two pictures together. It's easy not to do, I think, and I also wanted to sort of say, if there was one thing that really struck you that you found yourself telling people after the conference, you know, people that you particularly wanted to communicate with, what is it?
Geez, I'm trying to think of which one.
Yeah, there was a lot.
Yeah, my concern, I think one of my underlying concerns was Alaska Native people being at the table. And I know that Alaska Native people already participate in a number of international, national, Alaskan organizations addressing developmental, environmental, and social issues in the circumpolar region. But the symposium discusses the laws and policies and agreements between nations. But some of that discussion, I think, stirs up some other areas as well, and one of the examples is in a symposium where there was a presentation about whether Indigenous peoples in Greenland were actually Indigenous under law. So that kind of stirred the pot.
It's good to stir the pot once in a while. It gets the conversation going.
Yeah, and you know, I disagreed with him, and we were able to have that kind of discussion. We were able to have that disagreement and have that exchange, which is so critical for resolving issues and for building policy that affects all of us. And now we are talking about a particular umbrella over the circumpolar region where all these nations, which include the Indigenous peoples who are most affected, be at the table, mm-hmm. and come to some kind of government-to-government resolve.
So, Diane, did you feel like there were enough, you came as an academic, but were there enough people in the audience like you that did you feel like, I'm just trying to think, was the whole ladder of humanity there, or was it really very academic?
It was, I would say no, only in that I certainly would have liked to have seen more Native involvement. Mm-hmm. But then sometimes I imagine they're all quite busy too.
True.
But that, I think, it was clear to me that there was a lot of interest by international guests in issues of an understanding of Native knowledge and holistic approaches for incorporating Native knowledge into some of the solutions as we look at certain environmental and other issues.
So, Diane, I just want to say you have this unique opportunity. You've got the two organizers here. Is there one question from the conference that you would love to ask one of them? You know, something that evolved in your thinking while you were sitting as a member of the symposium, just listening. Is there anything that you would either point out or ask these guys?
Gosh, I can't think offhand.
Okay. I did put you on the spot. I'm sorry. Yeah.
And Diane, I would say this is Betsy, and thanks for your participation. But you've touched on a number of issues that were sort of eye-openers for me as well. And I think one of the great delights of the conference was, so we had about 50 to 60 guests from around the world. And then in Anchorage especially, we had a very large number of local practitioners because the Alaska Bar Association has a new section on Arctic law. And to see both the international guests just soaking up the information about Alaska and seeing how Alaska's legal landscape is really very different, yet also offers models to the rest of the world, I think was very gratifying. And in turn, to see the Alaska audience, attorneys and others, hear people from around the world offer their perspectives was very enriching. And just one example, so a practitioner, an academic from Norway, after his presentation on a very technical question of choice of law rules for liability for oil spills transboundary, he's worked on Russia and Norway. And he said, I'm looking for somebody in the United States to work with me on Russia and the U.S. approaches to this. And sure enough, later, there he was talking to a practitioner here from Anchorage very right. excitedly about how are we going to work on this together.
Right, which is the benefit of pulling people together like that and giving space to talk without, you know, I mean, yes, you have agenda items and you have discussion topics, but you make room for things to sort of breathe and different discussions to take place. But anyway, Diane, thank you so much for calling in. I bumped into you there on Saturday, and I appreciate that you called in and participated here, too. So thank you.
Well, thank you so much.
Let's see. I actually you brought up the Norway lawyer, and that was one that I wanted to talk about, just because I when I think about something as high level as this conference and lawyers and legal, just the complexity of it all, trying to paint a picture for people that they can think about and walk away with, and that was one of them, which was, you know, yes, it was a technical discussion between, you know, Norway and Russia and who shows up when something bad happens and who pays for it. But the last slide in that was, you know, the Bering Straits region and Alaska and Russia. And some mention, no specifics, but that there's oil resources out there that will probably someday be, you know, developed. And so, you know, we certainly lived through the Gulf disaster, and we're trying to learn, I think, and this is some of the science that you guys maybe can speak to, learn what will happen if there's anything like that in the polar areas. You know, how will oil behave? It's a different temperature. You know, I in fact, one of the presenters had a poster there that was about, response. And it was about burning the oil, because that's actually one of the better ways to get rid of it in a cold climate. I never thought of that. You immediately think, ooh, toxic smoke or something like that. But in fact, that's really the best way to get rid of it. So anyway, it's just interesting. Let's see. I want to throw out our phone numbers here. This is Hometown Alaska. We have Betsy Baker and Mara Kimmel. They just organized and participated heavily in this conference called a symposium on polar law, which had people from all over the world here in Anchorage talking about their polar issues and listening to Alaska's version of polar discussions. And if you'd like to give us a call, it's 550-8433 in Anchorage, or 1-888-353-5752 for statewide. Or you can send us an email at hometownatalaskapublic.org. And I do have an email. Let me share it with you guys. Regarding rapid changes in the Arctic due to climate change and the associated social environmental justice issues, I'd like to know how your guests feel about the effort to leave remaining fossil energy in the ground. Okay.
It's one of many initiatives surrounding offshore oil and gas in not just the United States Arctic, but really globally. Mm-hmm. And it's been interesting to watch the discussion with Shell's announcement and also to watch the discussion around President Obama's visit, where many people felt he did not really address what some view as an inconsistency between approving Arctic drilling and his climate change policies.
We're in a transition, but that was never really fleshed out.
Right. And I, to answer the caller's question, I think it's a very important movement and an important discussion to be had publicly, but also to be put out there in the broader, to borrow a hackneyed phrase, court of public opinion, for people really to look and see what can we be doing collectively to address climate change, whether it's individual actions, whether if your belief is that we need to keep that in the ground, how do you most effectively keep it in the ground? Is it through market mechanisms? There's a lot of, I think one of the more interesting and sophisticated approaches right now is looking at what information about climate risk is being made public in securities and exchange filings, right? So there are many ways to go about getting at that information, but it's just one piece. And another important piece is what the oil industry itself is doing in beginning to answer some of those questions. And I think the type of movement the caller is asking about has helped prompt some of that discussion.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to take another caller online. I'd like to welcome Diane from Seward. Hi, Diane. You're on Hometown Alaska.
Hey, good afternoon. I am curious what the comments from your guests would be as to why the United States is not a signer to the Treaty of the Law of the Seas.
Fortunately, we have a very easy answer. Mead Treadwell gave just a wonderful talk as our Saturday keynote address, and the talk will be posted on the conference website. He really gave a comprehensive history as to how this started out as something that the United States has long supported and how it's become a real hot potato politically. He did a great service to our international guests as well, because Mara and I and anybody who speaks at an Arctic conference, no matter the topic, that's the first question we get. But it's I with being aware of our time, would refer all of our listeners to that talk, which will be posted shortly and well worth a listen to learn a little bit about Alaska history as well.
Right. We do have the website listed on alaskapublic.org under Hometown Alaska. And based on discussions before the show, I know we're going to add a couple of other links there for people who are interested and want to follow and how to keep up. So we will make sure after the show that we add a few more links. So anything else, Diane? Did we answer your question?
Yes. Well, I do have another question, actually. Are we the only country that's not signing? that's an Arctic country, an Arctic nation?
That's an Arctic nation. That's correct. We're the only non-member among the eight Arctic states.
Well, I look forward to seeing Mr. Treadwell's comments. Thank you for your time.
Thank
ladies.
You.
What is going to be on the website? Just the keynotes, or is there a variety of things that are going to be on there? You don't know yet. You're still thinking about it.
Well, no, actually, what I was sighing about is the fact that we will actually be pulling together a yearbook of polar law that will include papers that were delivered at the conference. So
right.
Stay tuned for that. And then in terms of the actual website, I think Betsy can speak to that.
Just Mead's address and also the Saturday morning panel of practicing lawyers asking what is this emerging Arctic law practice. So those are the only two audio recordings that will be posted.
Okay. And this polar yearbook or this yearbook, what kind of timeline are we talking about? Should people come back and visit in 6 months?
Or a year.
Can
okay. I go back to the question of environmental justice
Absolutely.
That the email raised?
Absolutely.
Which is, I think, at the risk of sounding very lawyerly, I also think I sound very Alaskan when I answer this way. I think that one of the biggest concerns that Alaskans have had is being left out of decision making. And so in terms of, forgetting for a moment what your position on offshore
Anything.
Drilling
yeah.
might be or mm-hmm. anything might be, I think the real pertinent point that was raised by the question that was posed in the email is what is the role for Alaskans to play or Arctic residents to play? And one thing that all Arctic nations have in common is usually we are far from the seat of decision-making power. And so, again, it's that distance, it's that discrepancy in power and authority over our own lands and our own resources, things that we depend on, that really drives a lot of the issues of justice in a northern environment.
Right. I think that might speak to why people were sort of so overwhelmed by the president's visit. Somehow it seemed like he charmed everybody, but he was so human about it. And I guess they don't think of authority being on the ground like that. It seems distant. It doesn't seem human. I wonder if that might have.
No, I think that's
flavored.
Exactly right. That's, I think, why he had such a positive reception when he came here. Again, no matter what your political stripe
right.
was, the fact that he came here mattered to us because we have felt so distant and so marginalized, I think, through political processes. And you see this, again, throughout Alaska's history and the rhetoric and what created the state in the first place, but in almost any context, too, because you also see it with the efforts that tribes are making to integrate themselves into decision-making processes, which is ongoing. And it was a topic that we discussed in the conference as well. But I think just taking these 2 years that the U.S. has the Arctic chair or the chairmanship of the Arctic Council, I think we're in a really good place to take advantage of that spotlight mm-hmm. and start talking about the experiences of living in the Arctic and the subarctic.
It feels like a new day, actually, to me. So we're going to take a little break now. You're listening to Hometown Alaska. Our guests are Mara Kimmel and Betsy Baker, two Anchorage residents and lawyers who really organized a major international conference here on polar law. So we're going to come back and talk a little bit more about some of the other topics and maybe leave you with some things to think about in the second half hour. So this is Hometown Alaska, and I'm Kathleen McCoy.
You're listening to Hometown Alaska from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 8 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Hometown Alaska on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back to Hometown Alaska. I'm your host, Kathleen McCoy, and today we've been talking about polar law, not something we talk about every day, but maybe we're going to start talking more about it. We have Mara Kimmel and Betsy Baker on with us today, and they just finished up sort of organizing and participating heavily in this really international conference of representatives from nations that all sort of touch the Arctic and the Antarctic, which I know we didn't go very deep into that, but I loved listening to all the Australians that were visiting because they have great voices. But mostly we're in the North and we're very focused on the North. And so we're going to pick back up with where we were. I'm going to share our phone numbers one more time. We've had some great callers and some interesting observations. And I think people are thinking Arctic. I think I described the eggshell is broken and it's out there. And I think your everyday Anchorage resident is thinking that way too. So we've got two great people in the studio who can answer a lot of different questions or perspectives at 550-8433 in Anchorage or 1-888-353-5752 statewide. And of course, you can email us at hometown@alaskapublic.org. So did you want to revisit Shell at all? In the break, we were just mentioning that. Was there something there related to human rights there? Or I had a topic to propose, so I'm kind of open.
Well, in the questions you gave us to think about before we arrived,
yes.
I think you characterized their announcement as shocking.
Mm-hmm.
And I was reflecting on that. I think Shell's announcement, more than shocking, is sobering. No matter what your view of Arctic offshore drilling is. And I'd like us just to step back for a minute and think about this as more than a win for the conservation community or a loss for Shell and offshore drilling. And think about what we have learned and where we do go forward and how we go forward.
Mm-hmm.
It's a hugely complex issue. And I think some of the things we've learned is that, in fact, there are arenas in which those two communities have worked well together. So thinking about how the Pew Environment Trust worked with Shell to propose, I mean, Pew created the report and made it available to the regulatory bodies working on this. How can we improve Arctic offshore oil and gas standards and operational standards for the U.S. Arctic?
Mm-hmm.
And that's a process that's ongoing, but a really detailed report that looks at many of the arrangements that Alaskans have been involved in creating over the years, thinking about what we've learned from the Alaska Eskimo Walrus Commission and some creative legal mechanisms there, the conflict avoidance agreements that then eventually become part of the permitting process. So that there are good lessons we can share with the rest of the world. And I also think, and it is sobering, I've already been talking to friends whose jobs are changing because of this announcement. But thinking long term, what the Northwest Arctic Borough, the North Slope Borough, the communities affected by this decision, I know that there's an immediate and great and real disappointment in there not being that source of revenue, which would also be very long term, by the way. But I think it's a nudge in the right direction for us collectively in the state to think about our economy. And there have been some great articles in the ADN and some other discussions. And how do we take this breathing spot to think about things like renewables? The Arctic Energy Summit that's just wrapping up in Fairbanks today, I know, has had a lot of discussions about that. So it may be a nudge that's welcomed by some and not by others, but it really forces us to think about how do we diversify the economy here. And then just one last thought. So this oil wouldn't have been produced for 30 years anyway, if you read Shell's discussions. And we all know it's a long-term play. But think about 30 years from now, we will have better technology for exploration and for exploitation. It will be cleaner. It will be safer. It just by virtue of how these things are developed over time with experience from other parts of the Arctic.
It's true.
And we'll also probably have higher and better uses for petroleum. And I think that that's an important nugget.
Yeah. I have two quick thoughts. One is, why is it that we always, there's a winner and a loser in every one of these things? And I think the word sobering really hit me, right? Because it was like a setback, like we haven't figured something out, or it was a blow. My first thought was, wow, that was a huge blow for them. I mean, it's been difficult for the last 3 or 4 years for them. Then you look at the dollar amount that's gone. And obviously, they don't do this lightly. They, you know, it was serious. And so I kind of thought about, wow, you know, as humanity, are we smart enough to figure this out? The Arctic is really giving us a kick here. And, you know, you just sort of assume wherever we go, we're gonna get what we want. And it didn't happen here. So that word sobering really strikes me as appropriate. I guess I just didn't expect it. I guess I just did not expect it. I mean, they've come back so many times that I just thought they would not pull out like that, you know. So I'm just imagining how difficult it was for them, you know. I mean, even if you're, no matter what your viewpoints are. So I also think we don't solve things if we stay on opposite sides of the room. And we have such a tendency in our culture at this point in time, I think for a lot of reasons, information overload, busy lives, you don't have time to sort it all out. And which is why I like shows like this that might take these complex things and give your average busy parent, you know, who's living in this amazing age that we're in, and these things are happening right now, a chance to participate and you know, feel like they have a grip on, a little bit of a grip on what's going on. So I'm open to anything you want to talk about. I was going to suggest one of the things that snagged me was I didn't get to sit through this conference, but it was a breakout session. But people coming out of it were just so animated and talking, and it had to do with, and I'm probably oversimplifying it, looking at Mara, you know, what they were talking about was, you know, Native corporations and their shareholders, and then sort of responding to their tribal community, and that those two things aren't always in alignment. And I was sort of thinking, since Native corporations are a big part of Alaska and we don't know that much about them, it might be an opportunity to just flesh that out a little bit for people and maybe share some of the viewpoints that came out in that breakout. I'm really open to how we do that. It just snagged me as, boy, I'd like to know more about that.
Sure. And I think as Alaskans, we do know a lot about Alaska Native corporations. And we do know, for example, that they are some of the top economic drivers in our state. Today at lunch was the Alaska Business Monthly announcement of the top 49. And I'm not sure what they were for this year, but I do know that in years past, Alaska Native corporations have been amongst the top of the top 49. And so they're huge economic drivers in our state, which I think dovetails nicely on Betsy's point, which is we will need to be diversifying. And in fact, I think Alaska Native corporations, not all of them, but many of them, provide excellent examples about how to diversify portfolios. That said, I think that what was interesting was a couple of different points in the conference. One, that the existence of Alaska Native corporations as distinct from tribal governments is something that people outside of Alaska are not very familiar with. So that was a great opportunity to share that information. The second thing that struck me was the that lack of knowledge, and I don't mean that to sound disparaging, but that lack of a conversation even amongst members of the Alaska Bar, so attorneys in town who may, or throughout the state, who also may not understand the full distinction between corporate land ownership as opposed to tribal governance, and what and how some of those things can come in conflict, and also, right now, as lawyers, people are looking at the possibility of putting lands back into trust status, federal trust status, so that tribes can reassert some level of governance over those lands. Those remain to be, they're incredibly open legal questions. People don't know exactly how that's going to unfold and what the impacts of that will be, but these are some of the issues that we're dealing with in the state.
Right. I think of that in terms of, I've heard in terms of discussions related to education and self-directed schools and, successes in other countries like New Zealand, people interested in duplicating that here, and yet it's a really big question. And here it is, we're talking about polar regions, and it pervades many, many policies that the state might have going forward.
Yeah, and again, just to sound the same tune that I've been sounding this whole show, I think that we have an opportunity up here in the North to do things differently. And part of that opportunity, again, is restructuring the way decisions are made to ensure that local communities, local people, whether it's a tribal government, whether it's a city council, in a small community in rural Alaska, whether it's the city of Anchorage or the borough of Juneau, people want to have a say in their own futures. Education, economics, social, all of those things. And so it's figuring out how to do that. And we do have those opportunities up here. And that, again, is why conferences like this are so important to Alaska, is that we can learn from other people how they're doing it in other areas, and some of the successes, and we can share some of our successes as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's important. I was thinking about the woman from, she was from the University of Lapland, I think, and she was talking about, communities doing their own negotiating with oil companies one-on-one. And I thought that was really remarkable. And I thought without the protection of your government, and she went on to explain that the government was viewed somewhat suspiciously, that if you got a good deal with an oil company, they might take some of it away. And then, I thought that was interesting. And then I met up with another woman who represented a borough on the North Slope, who talked about them negotiating very specifically with Shell. So, I mean, it's, I don't know, I felt like I had a very simple idea that the government would be there to protect your interests. And I still sort of want to think about government that way. But clearly in her experience, and the audience was really interested in asking her more about it, was just like, it felt patronizing. It felt like you're on your own. If you're not a good negotiator, your local community won't do very well, but one that is a good negotiator will do well. It was all done in secret. Nobody really knew what So it's very fascinating when I think about what we've tried to do in Alaska with the locals that were here before we got here. I would say we've done some things right, not everything right, but that just really struck me as very different from what we've done. And I might be wrong, although, Christine Hess from the borough was saying that had worked well for them to negotiate directly with I'm just sort of thinking, is there an overarching way to think about that, or is it sort of everybody's on their own? And I mean, if you do have an umbrella legal organization or governmental organization, sometimes people feel like we get those terms federal overreach, you're telling us how to do it. And yet, isn't there a better way to organize this process so people do well than just every man for himself or every woman for herself?
My own opinion is that there is, and this is what my paper was on, and it's what my research has been on, and actually my practice of law has focused on, is sharing power with between local communities, state communities, and federal communities. And we do talk a lot about federal overreach in our state, but the thing that we don't understand is that sometimes there needs to be that overarching structure. You know, we're a country that's built on this idea of sharing power between layers of government. And we did that on purpose in the 1700s because we recognized even back then that local interests can be very different than national interests. And so we're doing nothing more when we advocate for sharing power between tribes or municipalities or boroughs and the state and the federal government. We're utilizing that federalist approach to making good decisions. And also that way, too, like the Northwest Arctic Borough, as a political subdivision, has the power of the state to bring to bear when they're negotiating with organizations like Shell. And so it's being able to recognize, you know, and this is going back to your earlier question, too, about some of the differences between a corporation and a government, recognizing that they have very different constituencies mm-hmm. and that a government's job is to take care of its people and a corporation's job is to take care of its shareholders. Alaska Native corporations are very different in that regard, mm-hmm. but nevertheless, there's that ultimate financial obligation that they have that mm-hmm. a government just doesn't have.
Right.
So it's figuring out how to share power, how to give people a seat at the table.
Yeah.
And also acknowledging, to build on Mara's comments, that thank goodness laws aren't the only structures that govern this, right? Mm-hmm. That there are voluntary arrangements that we can turn to for best practices. There are the Native corporations themselves. I mentioned earlier the Alaska Eskimo Whaling Commission and it being very proactive in protecting its interests when the oil companies first started approaching the communities on the North Slope mm-hmm. and coming up with some very innovative measures to make sure that the whaling season was protected mm-hmm. during offshore operations. Mm-hmm. The much more complicated story than that. But we're also now in the North Slope, you know, maybe we need our own Native NGO and not just an environmental NGO and, mm-hmm. and steps in that direction being taken. Some talk about the need for an RCAC, a Regional Citizens Advisory Council for the Arctic. So many of the Arctic communities are overwhelmed with requests to respond to EISs, on comment making, on rulemaking, excuse me.
Right.
And so how do you take control of the flow of information in and out of your own community? And
right.
So a lot of discussion going on this point
yeah.
indicates that the legal system isn't necessarily getting it right in the regulatory system. And something we heard repeatedly was the need for treating Alaska Native comments in a rulemaking process differently than just any other citizen participating in that process. So, mm-hmm. and one thing that we tried to ask in each session was you in the audience and you on the panels, what's the one regulatory change you would make and how are you going to go about working on it to improve the issue you care about?
Mm-hmm.
And so we will, I think, see some answers mm-hmm. to that in the published papers.
Yeah.
I also wanted to touch on something that we have not yet addressed, which was addressed throughout the conference, which is this idea of traditional knowledge and science and what is science. And I think one of the points that was made in the Fairbanks portion was that traditional knowledge is a corollary to it. It does not get subsumed within a Western science model, but actually can serve to inform and be informed that both models of knowledge acquisition, can inform each other and develop alongside each other. And if you look at, for example, the White House's Climate Change and Resilience Task Force recommendations, a big part of that was dedicated to understanding that traditional communities have a lot of knowledge to bring to bear, a lot of science to bring to bear on decision-making processes. And so, again, it's utilizing and recognizing traditional knowledge bases as right alongside Western scientific method ways of gathering information, mm-hmm. a very vital part of the policies that we want to develop
yeah,
for the North.
Yeah. You mentioned early on that just the way the state came into being. And I was thinking about what you were meaning there. And I was thinking, well, it was sort of like we have all these resources. We're valuable to the U.S. You should make us a state, you know, because we have what you need. But it didn't include the people. You know, it felt more like open for business or a resource that you need, but not, you know, I don't know.
I think that the state came to be because we were tired of feeling taken for granted by the federal government, and we were tired of acting as a resource colony. And so the state came to be in order to take back some of that sense of control and of purpose over our own resources, which is why we negotiated for such a large chunk of land. The state owns a quarter of the lands within our borders, which is, I don't know the exact number, but it ranks fairly highly amongst other states in terms of how much land we have at our disposal. Mm-hmm. And then also, one of the other really interesting components of our state's constitution is this idea that local governance is prevalent and local governance should be emphasized. So even rejecting Juneau as being the seat of power in favor of dispersing authority throughout mm-hmm. the state.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I was thinking about the boosterish sort of, I definitely hear you, because I think salmon were being, that was one of the big issues. They had to be restored, basically, after there was state control. So we are actually, I'm going to throw out our phone numbers one more time. It's 550-8433 in Anchorage, and it's 1-888-353-5752 statewide, or you can still send us an email at hometown@alaskapublic.org. But in getting ready for the show, I did want to save this sort of last segment for, you know, what you want to leave listeners with. We do want to talk about how they can keep up. You know, it's a whole new world. It's not just Anchorage. It's not just Alaska. It's the poles. It's the Arctic. So there are some good websites. We've put some on our alaskapublic.org, but we're going to add some more. But I really am, you know, you guys are incredible experts. What takeaways do you want to give to your average Anchorage, you know, citizen, you know, to think about? I know that's hard because this was...
Well, I would just say, this is Mara, I would just say that, you know, one of the amazing things about being in Alaska is that we are bridging the globe at the top of the world. And as such, we are in a position to really take advantage of the knowledge, the expertise, the awareness, the wisdom that comes both from our own people, but also from the circumpolar north. And I think that we have an opportunity to really educate ourselves and to educate the rest of the world about moving into a future that is increasingly globalized, increasingly networked, and really taking a leadership role and using the knowledge that has sustained Alaskans for 10,000 years and really positioning ourselves well to go into the future.
Yeah. You know, I just wanted to say that this group has been meeting for 8 years, but it was a community. I mean, you did get the sense they were even remembering a few people who have passed. I mean, it was not what you think you're going to get at a conference. You know, it really was, there has been developed something over those 8 years that is a kind of informal structure that who knows what benefits might come from.
Oh, absolutely.
That.
Yeah. And people care deeply about the subject. And I guess the one takeaway I would say is that it was very clear from all of the speakers, the change is real. And I think the challenge to listeners and to people at the symposium is what is each of us going to do about it? And for the lawyers in the room, talking about how law basically often just reacts and waits. It's not in place before the problem arises. The Oil Pollution Act was not in place when the ExxonMobil happened, right?
Yeah.
And so to think now about what changes we would like to see in the legal system and work toward those, anticipating for clients and for the broader public.
Yeah. I do think about how when the Exxon Valdez happened and you found that there were no baseline studies on the species that were, so we really don't know how they're doing because we didn't know how they were doing before. It almost makes me think of taking an assessment of what we have at this moment and what we value, because sometimes you hear discussions of how do you value a way of life or the experience of being in a place alongside economic value. I mean, those, you know, how do those get weighted? And you know, sometimes you don't realize something was wonderful till it's gone. So what lessons can we learn from just in the past where we, gosh, wish we knew that before this was over, you know? So I it's hard to do what you're suggesting, Betsy, I think.
Well, but one example that was made very clear, I think it was Phil Blumstein who said part of the problem in the lack of the communities to respond was that there wasn't a structured overarching borough government, right? That you didn't have the structures in place, whether that's the answer or another for us to think as citizens about what structures do we want in place that the law can support.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm gonna welcome Don on Hometown Alaska. Hi, Don. You've got a question for us?
Well, that maybe a comment or two. Gallatiner came very close to reminding people that the Constitution is the law of the land, not the Supreme Court. I'd like to pay her some compliments for that, among other things, along with some of the stuff she said about the state and whatnot, wanting to govern her own. I think there's some missed points and some distortions here that certain things did not change right away. Mm-hmm. And there are still a lot of places in the federal Constitution where Alaska tends to ignore it. Protection of the citizens, including the natives, the Indians. A lot of this stuff was, you know, it's been like Jim Crow. It's been swept right out of the way. And people tend to use their local law to gain local favoritism and have their rhetoric say and disregard the federal Constitution, which is the foundation and the main purpose was to protect everybody, mm-hmm. not just certain segments. It's the same way with religion. I.e., when I was in school, you didn't have the words under God in the Pledge of Allegiance. You did not have this concept that this was a Christian democracy, which is still a farce that a lot of people push today.
Okay, thank you, Don. Did you have any question, or did you just basically want to tell us that?
Yeah, there's reference in the Constitution about nature and nature's law, and I think the environmentalists are sticking a lot closer to that than some of the developers who are more interested in exploiting Alaska, period,
okay.
rather than just going along with a mix of, say, solar energy, tidal energy, and everything along with oil.
Right. Don, thanks for calling in. I appreciate it, and thanks for listening to Hometown Alaska. I really appreciate it. We just have, you know, 3 minutes, 2 minutes left. We wanted to put a few websites out there, I think, and we will put them on our site, but maybe we could talk just briefly about them, what you recommend.
Sure. One of our callers mentioned Fran Ulmer and Mead Treadwell, both of whom have Fran is the current chair of the U.S. Arctic Research Commission. If you go to arctic.gov, you can find their great daily newsletter and updates on things
newsletter.
Like this.
Don't always read it. That's the problem.
And there's another called The Arctic This Week, and that's put out by thearcticinstitute.org.
Mm-hmm. One of the things I'm going to take away from this show is just some optimism that we can do it differently, that we can be creative, and the fact that we might be frustrated or burned or cynical. I don't know. That's just such a waste of your time and looking for sort of new ways to make it better. And it certainly does strike me that having everybody at the table is one way you're going to do that. So what about you, Mary? Anything you want to talk
about? I'm just really grateful for the opportunity to come on the show and talk about this amazing symposium. And I look forward to all of Alaska getting engaged over the next couple of years.
Yeah, I think that's, you know, we didn't even tell people where this came from, out of Iceland, right? Wasn't that the founding organization that got this polar law thing started? Is it a law school or is it just a university? Or?
It's the Polar Law Institute at the University of Akureyri, and ever since the Arctic Center or the Arctic Circle was established, it now works in conjunction with that as well.
Well, thank you. We never did say that. So I'm just going to thank our guests. Thank you, Betsy and Mara, for this free-ranging discussion on a 4-day conference. Thank you so much, and thanks to our listeners and callers. I really appreciate hearing what you want to know and letting you ask our guests what you want to know. Next week on Hometown Alaska, Charles Wolforth will be back as your host. His topic is the real characters of Anchorage history: Joe Spinard, Russian Jack, Lynn Airy. That sounds like a lot of fun. Hometown Alaska is on the web at alaskapublic.org. Pat Yak is the chief content officer of Alaska Public Media. Dave Waldron was our audio engineer today. Thanks so much for joining us on Hometown Alaska. I'm Kathleen McCoy. Boy.
Hometown Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Hometown Alaska's theme song, Lead Dog, is by Kevin Barnett from Eagle River. Learn more about Hometown Alaska and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.